It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to the Wayne's Comics Podcast. It's time for episode 155, and have I got a treat for you. I've got a great interview with Brian Talbot, creator of many great works, including The Tale of One Bad Rat, The Adventures of Luther Arkwright, and particularly we're going to talk about his ongoing series called Granville. The latest hardcover has just come out, and that's called Granville Noel, based around the Christmas season. We talk about how the characters came to be and what kinds of things he has in mind for them and how long the series is going to continue, as well as other things that he's working on. There's a lot to get to, so let's get on with the show.
Name's Talbot. Brian Talbot.
The Badger is back! No Badger does it better.
I want to welcome to the podcast, Brian Talbot. Oh,
thank you.
Oh, it's good to have you here. Good to talk with you because you're the creator of Granville Noel, a book that has just come out from over here in the States, from Dark Horse. And it's one of the great books, I think, out this year. I love that these Granville stories always come out in hardcover. Is that anglicized? It should be Granville or something?
No, I pronounce it Granville.
You do? Okay.
Because in the actual story, if you actually heard them speaking, it would be Granville.
Mm-hmm.
But you probably notice I have this conceit in the story that everything you see, everything you read in the balloons is actually translated from French.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
So even when they're in England, they're actually speaking French, but it's translated into English for the balloons. That's why I always pronounce it Granville.
Do you want to talk a little bit about where the concept for the Granville series came from?
Yeah, I mean, I like them in hardcover. I mean, I don't know if they look like American kids' annuals, but they're meant to look a bit like, you know, Victorian to about 1930s children's annuals, almost. Even though they're for adults. I'm just trying to keep that sort of thing, because they had a lot of anthropomorphic characters in them, those stories. And as you know, so is Granville. Or actually, strictly speaking, it should be zoomorphic if it's about animals. But yeah, the reason why they're animals and the original inspiration came directly from Jean-Ignace Isidore Girard, who's a Victorian. Well, he wasn't. He lived in the first half of the 19th century in France, and he did a lot of these illustrations and satirical cartoons showing animals, you know, in then contemporary dress, and they were satirizing public fashion and mores and public social habits and things like that, the French of the time. And he used to sign these illustrations J.J. Granville. That was his, or Granville, that was his nom de plume. And I've got a book about it with his stuff in that I've had for decades. And shortly after I finished Alice in Sunderland, I was looking through it. And because he was a big influence, you know, on John Tenniel, who did the Alice in Wonderland illustrations, the original ones. And I was looking through this book, and it just suddenly occurred to me, well, Granville, that could be the nickname of Paris in an alternative world where it's the biggest city in the world, in a world populated by animal characters. And it just That was the idea. I thought about it for about a week, and after a week, I just roughly plotted out the first story, and then sat down and typed it. And I typed it all out in 5 or 6 days. It was amazing. It was like taking dictation. I wish the rest had come like that, because I mean, usually with graphic novels, I spend years thinking about them, and this one just came in a complete flood of inspiration. It was great. I could hear the characters talking and everything.
Wow. No, that's great. Now, so you write the script then before you do the art?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well before. Actually, the fifth one, which I'm hoping to start next summer, start drawing. I actually wrote the script for that over 2 years ago now.
Wow.
But it's, managed to fitting it in. But that's one of the things I've been doing with the Granville books, actually. After I finished the first one, I wrote the script for the second one. And then I've sort of been getting ahead. So, by the time I'd finished the second one, I'd already written the script for the third one. I mean, the fourth one, the Granville Noel, which I've just came out. I'd actually written the script about 2 years before I started work on that.
Mm. Wow. Well, it's great stuff. The stories are so interesting, and the characters are so fleshed out and believable. You know, like LeBrock, for example, the inspector, he is just somebody that I just feel like I know after all this time. He has certain ways of handling situations. Because he's a badger, he does things like a badger might in that circumstance. Which
one
I like.
Of those things about using animals, I mean, he has the deductive abilities of Sherlock Holmes, but being a badger, he's a bit of a bruiser,
He's a great character. And I like the way you draw him, too, because he's got this... It's hard to know if a badger could, be like in that situation. He really does look like that to me. And so I really like the way that you draw it. I think that you've got the character just superbly down as far as the writing goes, and also as the art, as the way he appears.
Oh, cheers. Yeah, I always knew he'd be working class as well from the beginning, because badgers over here in children's stories, they very often tend to be sort of working class characters, sort of miners almost. And I do have a set of children's Woodland Snap from the 30s. It has this badger who's obviously a miner on his way back from work, with the helmet on and everything.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of the times when you draw the characters, they look like human beings might look. There is resemblance. Like his assistant, for example. His assistant looks very much like what a smaller assistant-type guy would look like, even though he's a mouse.
I mean, some people doing anthropomorphic stuff do the full sort of anthropomorphic, isomorphic sort of model, so that, the characters, although they're walking on two legs, they do have sort of paws and tails and things like that. I'm actually using the model based on the set of, very famous set of British children's comics over here called Rupert the Bear. This has been around since 1920. This strip set as a newspaper strip. But the albums have been coming out since the 30s. And they have this sort of convention with basically it's humans with animals' heads, and everything about them is human apart from the head, which gives the character.
And it's so interestingly done. And now, when you're coming to write the stories of the books, I'm just kind of curious, because this one in particular deals with a very specific subject, and that's religion. And the other ones, too, there are very specific subjects or mysteries that are going on into it. Well, how do you get the inspiration, or where does the story come from? Is this something that as you go along, something kind of presents itself to you, as opposed to, maybe somebody suggesting something to you?
No, you never quite know where the ideas come from and the story. As I said, the first one came as a flood of inspiration, and after I got the title and the idea of the setting, I thought, well, I've probably done a detective story. I'd like to do a detective story because I'm a big fan of crime fiction. And so it's, he's investigating a murder in the story. And I thought of the first one really as a bit like it's sort of Sherlock Holmes directed by Quentin Tarantino almost. And the second one, it's a bit like Sherlock Holmes directed by Alfred Hitchcock. It has these set pieces You know, mm-hmm. Hitchcock used to have these set pieces in with, you know, on big sets and stuff like that. It has these things sort of going on. There's several nods to Hitchcock in that.
Mm-hmm.
And the third one, of course, the theme behind, I mean, it's, I think it's pastiching, is the James Bond films in the back of it, you know, mm-hmm. in the back mm-hmm. of the story.
Mm-hmm. So where did the idea come about talking about religion then? Had you had this concept in your mind about dealing with how religion impacts on us?
It's not as much about religion, actually, I think, as about religious cults, you know, and things like Scientology and stuff like that. I mean, there's lots in the stories, in that cult, in the story, that I've actually just, you know, I've used. It's actually been used before in really religious cults. You know, mm-hmm. some phrases and some of the things, you know, the sort of programming they do and stuff like this.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's not just about cult, religion, I don't think. It's not just about religious cults. The fourth one, mm-hmm. Noel, it's also about con men, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's about con men and fascism. Mm-hmm. So roll them into one. Mm-hmm. You probably won't know this, but the unicorn, who's like this messianic, charismatic leader of the cult,
mm-hmm.
His second in command, who's mm-hmm. called Nicholas Griffin.
Mm-hmm.
He's actually visually based on the Tenniel's Griffin from Alice Through the Looking Glass.
Oh, really?
If you notice, he's chubbier and he has sort of wall eyes,
mm-hmm.
and he looks like the leader of the British National Party, which is a fascist organisation in Britain. he's called Nicholas Griffin. Nicholas Griffin, mm-hmm. rather. So mm-hmm. he's a reference to him. Mm-hmm. Although, actually, I think he's lost his job in the recent times, but lost his post.
Mm. Wow. So what made me think it might be about religion is because you would do some graphics in there that are based on religious artwork. Like, for example, there's a scene when Apollo was surrounded by all these people and they're talking about going somewhere, and it looks very much like the painting of Jesus at the Last Supper.
Yeah, it's actually directly based on Da Vinci's Last Supper. I was actually quite pleased with that, because each one of the characters at the table, they're actually saying something that suits the attitude that they're in.
Mm.
You know, they're all in these different sort of strange attitudes. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I've been doing that throughout the books, actually, in a way, not just about religion, but there's a lot of references to 19th century art mm-hmm. in the Granville stories that it's not necessarily for you to, you know what, recognize them, to understand the story, appreciate the story. But mm-hmm. The sort of Easter eggs are there for, you know, if people do recognize them, you know, it'd be an added bonus. I mean, in Noel, there's one big panel across the top of a page where they're walking through the snow, LeBrock and Chief Inspector Roche, you know, they're racooned, they're walking through the snow, and it's based on a Edouard Caillebotte painting called Rue de Paris en temps de pluie, and it's a quite famous painting. And there's another panel later on that's based on a pre-Raphaelite painting by Holman Hunt called The Awakening Conscience. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing this all the way through, actually.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, it really stood out this time, particularly to me, and I noticed the thing. Well, even on the cover, for example, Apollo's in something of a Christ-like crucifix position.
That's right. He's not crucified, but he has his arms out, like, you know, in crucifix shape.
I was
fascinated by the idea of the unicorn being a religious figure, because I don't know why people have this thing about unicorns, are pure and they're magical and everything. And all they are is a horse with a horn on its head. You know, and I thought, what happens when you put a horn on a horse? It suddenly becomes a magical creature. And as you know, in the story, he has this sort of charisma. He has this real animal magnetism, and which is a joke, but you know, when he talks, people want to believe him, want to love him, they want to believe every word he says, and it's all to do with his horn, really.
Well, I get a kick in one place in the dialogue. He even compares himself to Christ.
Yeah, that's right. Well, he believes he's Christ reincarnated. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So
I think that's a great thing about using animals as characters. You know, you can choose your animal to give the character. I mean, you see a crocodile standing there with a gun. You know, he's going to, not going to be up to any good, you know. Mm-hmm. You're not going to trust him, or a snake or something like that. I've done this quite a few times during the stories. You know, you've chosen the right sort of animal to portray certain qualities. And it's a bit like the, you know, the Italian comedy dell'arte, the theatre that uses masks. You know, the actors, they use masks to represent their character. And these characters, the people like Pantalon and Columbine and Piero, and they wear a mask that symbolises the character. And I think it's similar. So I think it must be similar to no theatre in Japan as well, but I don't know much about that. Mm-hmm. But basically, they're wearing masks, wearing animal masks that tell you something about their personality.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I said, some of the animals actually resemble or have it makes me think of a human person, you know, a human face as I look at them. And you know, it's a great job of doing that. You get not only the personality, but you kind of get the human.
It can be a bit hard sometimes. That's one of the tricky bits, you know, giving the animals a human expression.
Very good. But, and the other thing, too, I'm kind of fascinated, too, is, you know, you've got animals in here, but you also have humans. And humans are in sort of the lower tier of society as it goes along there, which is really kind of a nice parable for us to look at as we see, as we treat each other. And we see humans being treated by animals that way.
That's right. Yes, I wanted to do that from the beginning. The humans in the stories are second-class citizens with no citizenship rights, and they're really sort of an underclass who do all the sort of menial work, and the Parisians call them dough faces, a derogatory term for them. So it's basically, I'm talking about racism, you know, and they, in the story, they sort of start doing, you know, marches for equal rights and things like that. And of course, in Gamble Noel, you know, the political party that starts to build, they're trying to build on the fear of humans. The fear of the other, the fear of the foreigner, you know, the and which is what, you know, did in Nazi Germany and anywhere that's been fascist states.
And LeBrock actually works with a human
in the story. Well, as you've seen in the story, the you know, at the beginning of the story, he's as prejudiced almost as anybody else, you know, about humans. But getting to meet this human and who's an American called Chance Lucas, and working with him, they develop a relationship. I mean, it becomes a bit like a buddy movie, doesn't it? It's a bit like a buddy movie, and they're sort of friends by the end, so he respects humans by the end of it. And the character, Chance Lucas, is actually a riff on a famous French comic character called Lucky Luke. I don't know if you've heard of Lucky Luke. So this character's called Chance Lucas. Well, chance in French means luck, so it's Lucky Luke, basically. I mean, I've done that a few times in the series. There's references to famous European French and Belgian comic characters in the stories. I mean, Tintin, you know, Tintin is referenced, or Snowy is rather, his dog. And, you know, characters like Spirou and Becassine, the famous French cartoon characters, they've appeared as little sort of pastiches.
But so you're educating us as well as entertaining us.
Well, I mean, you don't. I imagine most readers won't recognise it, but they're just there for the people who do recognise these comic characters. Actually, in the third one, there's a scene where there's a human civil rights march in the street. And LeBrock and his psychic Roderick Ratzy are chasing this assassin through this crowd. And there's one panel where, if you look closely at some of the characters, there's you can see little Lulu is one of them, and Archie, you know, Archie and Jughead, and a couple of British comic characters are there as well.
Wow. So it pays to pay attention to your books here when you're reading them.
Well, yeah, I try and say something so serious, make a serious point in you know, as I go along, but mainly the sort of fun detective thrillers.
Well, there's an interesting contrast as I was reading the book that I really enjoyed between Billy who is sort of LeBrock's girlfriend, and all, and the daughter of Hannah, who is Hannah happens to be his like his maid, or the it's sort of like, you're right, like Holmes has a lady.
Yeah, landlady. He's a sort of Mrs. Doyle, you know. That's her name, Mrs. Doyle, Mrs. Hudson type character, yes.
Because it's interesting, because Billy reacts, well, there's an apparent reaction, but her reaction is somewhat different from Hannah's daughter, which I really like the fact that you're showing the difference, how different people react to the same person or the same stimulus to that.
Right, yeah.
I really like that. I was fascinated by the fact that, you know, that Billy gets sent in, and she apparently, you know, ends up in the Apollo's thrall.
Mm.
And I really like the fact that it wasn't quite that, it didn't turn out quite that way, and you still have Hannah's daughter struggling to believe and struggling to be, you know, faithful and to be in the inner circle with him. I just thought that was kind of an interesting comparison between the two of them, that just because they were there and they were brought in, they reacted very differently. And it's just like real people. When people become involved in these kinds of things, their reaction isn't quite the same. So you were teaching us about that too, that not everybody's going to react to this exactly the same way.
No. And as you see, LeBrock reacts differently as well. Really, at first, he is sort of enthralled, but he works out how to get around it.
Yeah, it's very good, because the story is really engrossing. And, you know, the moment I started to read it, I was in it until I was completely through, because I had to see how it works. And there's a nice little surprise at the end, too, which I don't want to talk too much about.
Mm.
But LeBrock's relationship with Billy kind of takes a significant step forward.
That's right.
Which
yeah.
is kind of fun, because we've seen Billy now for several.
He's been since the second one. It's been the relationship's been slowly developing.
Yeah, she's... Yeah. She's a fun character.
Yeah, she's great, right? She's very strong-willed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. She's the perfect one for LeBrock, because LeBrock is also sort of a strong-willed person. The two of them are going to buck heads, and they're going to love it, because that's what they enjoy doing.
But I do think that this fourth one, Noelle, has raised the bar on the whole series, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's improved a lot, and I think the best one is going to be the fifth one, which is... which will probably be the last one, I should think.
Oh, really? Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, because I've been enjoying them. I hope they go on for
quite a while. Yeah, well, they take me too long. They take me so long. That style, it's so time-consuming. It takes up to about 4 days for a page. And, you know, it takes longer to do the computer colouring, to do either the pencils or the inks. It's like fully painted digital artwork. But it does take me a long time, and especially after the fifth one is going to be, you know, they've all been 96 pages long, the stories. The fifth one, it's going to be it's something like 166 pages.
Wow.
So it's over half as long again. And although all the different books, the different stories have been standalone stories, there has been an overarching, you know, there's a story arc that's been building. And it all comes to fruition in the fifth one, which is going to be. I think it's definitely. Well, I think I can definitely say it's the darkest one of the five, but it's also quite exciting. There's a lot of action in it.
Mm-hmm. You don't know the name of it yet. You haven't announced that yet.
Yeah, I'm not announcing the name yet.
Okay.
Because it's going to be 2 or 3 years before it's out, so there's not much.
Oh, okay.
Because at the moment I'm working on Mary's next book. You know, I do these books with my wife as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know about those.
Yeah. Do you want to tell people about, well, you're bringing that up, but do you want to talk about a little bit about that?
We've been married for 40-odd years, and to see me drawing comics, and she's read the occasional graphic novel, and the ones I've suggested. So she's absorbed quite a lot, I think. And about 5 or 6 years ago, I mean, she was teaching in a university, she was a lecturer at university, and she took early retirement. And I suggested to her, you know, why don't you write a graphic novel, and I can I'll illustrate it. And she said, "Shall I write? What subject?" And I said, "Well, autobiographical graphic novels are very big now. Why don't you do an autobiographical one about the, you know, your very stormy relationship with your father?" And she did, and brought in James Joyce and all sorts of things. and modern dance and other things, and it became sort of half her autobiography and half a biography of Lucia Joyce, James Joyce's daughter, and it became the first British graphic novel to win a major literary award. It won 2 years ago. It won the Costa Award, which is one of the top British book awards. And it was amazing. We were on television and went to the big ceremony and everything. Met lots of stars. I was actually very pleased to meet Dave Gilmour, Pink Floyd, you know, lead guitarist. Yeah. It was for a brief time. You know, this sort of sparkling showbiz type situation over here. And anyway, her next book was Sally Heathcote's Suffragette, which is all about the suffragette movement. Which I think has just been published in America by Dark Horse, published here by Jonathan Cape. And that came out, well, it's just come out this month in America. And that was a three-way collaboration with Mary and I and the veteran illustrator Kate Charlesworth, who did a beautiful job on the finished artwork. You know. And I'm currently actually drawing Mary's third book, so... I have to do this before I can get stuck into the next round.
So you keep busy, sounds like.
Well, I do. If I'm at home, I work 7 days a week.
Oh, wow.
10 to 12 hours a day.
Wow.
But this last few months, it's been a bit hectic because we've been all over the place promoting Sally Heathcote. You know, lots of literary festivals. We actually get invited now to more literary festivals and comic conventions.
Well, that's unusual. I would expect you to get invited to a lot of comic conventions.
Yeah, a few, but we actually get invited more to literary festivals these days. Because I don't know about America, but the market for graphic novels has been really growing a lot in Britain. And they're becoming a very popular form of book.
Do you have an idea as to why that's happening?
Because there are so many good graphic novels around these days. I mean, I don't know if you remember the first graphic novel boom, you know, in the 80s. The general public started to get interested in them then, but once you've read half a dozen or 15 of the very best ones, there weren't very many around to read. But since then, they've been created sort of exponentially. Every year, there seems to be more and more graphic novels produced. Until we're in a position now where we have a whole range of quality graphic novels. You know, we've got this whole canon of quality work. So there's enough to, in any genre, in any style, from sort of abstract to photorealist. So there's enough quality stuff now to sustain this this boom. And I think that's the reason. As well as the rising the autobiographical and biographical graphic novels, which a lot of people are interested in biographies.
Well, one of the things, well, like for example, your books, they have a clear beginning, a middle, and an end. You know, if you buy like a monthly comic, it's oftentimes it's just the same thing going on month after month after month after month. There's really no end. And it, like your books, you have a satisfying ending. Things come to a conclusion. And I think a lot of graphic novels give people a way to do that, a way to end it and have a constructive story that concludes and wraps up and gives us a satisfaction rather than just the ongoing thing that happens.
Yeah, well,
do you think that's part of the
regular superhero comics tend to be, I mean, there's a huge sort of soap opera aspect to them. And that means it just go on and on and on and continue going. And you know, if somebody's killed, you know, they can imagine they probably will be back again within 6 months.
Boy, is that ever true? We're seeing now Captain America, and they're changing Captain America and Thor over here in Marvel. And everybody, you know, I always want to say to people, let's start a pool, you know, and kind of say who can get this closest to when they get back to their. To their identities, because you know Captain America. Of course, when the next movie comes out, they're going to want to have him back as Steve Rogers. So that's going to happen. So anyway, I just find that interesting. But in a sense, you have the freedom to do whatever you want with your characters because you don't have to worry about that kind of stuff. You're basically doing your thing, and you've got your characters, and you can shape them and move them into different places just because you know that you don't have to worry about what other mediums are doing with your characters.
That's right, yeah.
Also,
my editor, because the Granville books, they're commissioned by a British publisher and Dark Horse reprints. But my editor over here, you know, he just lets me do what I want, really.
Mm-hmm.
He's very hands-off, you know. So it's great. It's like sort of self-expression in a way. I can do exactly what I want with the characters.
Mm. Now, one of the things that you do in the Granville books that had always I have to smile at, and the British sensibility always makes me laugh. It's very, you know, Americans, we don't look at things quite the way that you all do, and it's always, for me, a great experience to see and get into the way other groups of people think. So it's one of the reasons I like Granville so much. I was so fascinated by the fact that France actually conquered Britain. In the books, and you know, you being British and everything, I was just sort of like, you know, what is that? Are you trying to say something about the British culture, or is this something that it's likely not to happen, that it's fun to explore something like that?
A couple of different reasons for it. I mean, the first and foremost, it was when I thought that with the original idea. I thought that Granville, which is nicknamed for Paris, you know, it had to be the biggest city in the world. I thought, well, how come Paris is the biggest city in the world? Mm-hmm. And I thought that was pretty easy. Yeah, Napoleon won the Napoleonic Wars, you know, 200 years ago. And France grew into this huge, globe-spanning empire, including conquering Britain. So that was a bit of a no-brainer, really. You know, I thought that's the obvious way that France could be so big if they'd won back then. And, you know, they could well have done, you know. And also the thing about these stories, it's like, turning things on the head, a lot of the things, which is why the humans are under the animals in the stories. But in the Granville stories, Britain, it doesn't have a queen, it doesn't have... It's a socialist republic. You know, which is like the opposite of what it actually is now, you know. It's, you know, completely ruled by capitalism in Britain. So it's sort of, you know, turning things on its head.
Mm-hmm. Well, Granville Noel is just a continuation of a terrific series. The Granville series to me has been one of the wonderful ones, and I keep my eyes out for it because I want to make sure I get the next one when it comes out. Because they've all been such fun reads and such great things and learning experiences too, like we've talked a little bit about. I really like the fact that sometimes you learn something when you read a book and said, you know, not just entertained, as we said, but educated. And the Granville series has just been a wonderful book, and I wish to you could keep this going for quite a lot longer, but I highly encourage anybody, if you haven't read them so far, be sure to go back and pick them up. They're available here in the States and over in the UK. The Granville series is a wonderful, wonderful series of books, and Granville Noel is the latest of the series, and it's just come out, so this is your chance to get in it. But you can actually read Granville Noel without reading the previous books, but you won't get quite as much out of it if you do that.
I try to design them to be standalone, as I said, a bit like the Tinted albums. You know, you're a bit like the old, I suppose, old TV shows and things, and like Star Trek. We used to be able to watch them any order, you know. But they're not quite like that. There is a story arc in the background. Each book is set about a month after the last one.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's good to know.
Yeah, so the first one's set in September, and by this point, the fourth one, we've reached December.
That's why we know all Christmas.
Yeah.
And that's great. Oh, so the next one will be what? In January?
Yeah,
when it comes?
That's right.
Okay, so that'll be good. Okay, well, boy, I love these books. It's so good to talk with you and talk about those books. I did want to mention one thing before we come to a conclusion real quickly. And there's a book of yours that I read a while back called The Tale of One...
Bad Rat.
Yes, that book was so far ahead of its time, the storytelling was, and the content of the story, what you were dealing with. And I'm not going to spoil it here, but I just want people to know, if you want to read a book that's ahead of its time, read this book, because it's a subject matter now that we're discussing now, but it wasn't back in the time when you wrote the book, but you were ahead of the curve with that. So The Tale of One Bad Rat, which is also available over here, do you want to give like a basic premise, a basic summary?
Yeah, it came out over 20 years ago. That book, in the early 90s originally. But the theme of the book is Beatrix Potter. I don't know who if Beatrix Potter's well known over there. She wrote The Tale of Peter Rabbit and things like that. It's not an anthropomorphic book. What it is, it's a book about the psychological after effects of child sexual abuse. And we follow this this girl called Helen Potter, who's run away from home because she's been abused. And she has this sort of undefined link, sort of synchronistic link, if you like, with Beatrix Potter, and sort of follows in her footsteps. And it's through this link that leads to her sort of coming to terms with herself. That's it, basically, yeah.
Because people weren't talking about this subject back in the early 90s, and I remember when I read it thinking, wow, this is just like a story that needs to be told and that people need to be aware of. And I just think that was a great book, too. I see your name someplace. I'm after the book because I'm sure it's going to be a good story good art.
I think it's this month that Dark Horse actually publish The Adventures of Luther Outright in the new edition. It's called the Outright Integral, because that's the French name for these albums when you have more than one story in. And it's Luther Outright and the sequel, Heart of Empire, in one nice big hardback book. It's about 550 pages long, and he reprints these two graphic novels alongside a gallery of about 20 Outright images and a 10-page interview with Steve Bissett. If you've not seen that, you might be interested in that, because it was the first British graphic novel published in the... It began serialization in 1978.
Very cool. Well, I love your work. I enjoy both the writing and the art, and it's rare that I can say that about comics creators, that I like both aspects of it. But, Brian, you do such a wonderful job. This Granville Noel is a wonderful addition and keeps the Granville series going particularly well. And I can't wait for your other stuff to come out. Once I get done reading your book, I want the next one to come out so I can get into that. So it's wonderful stuff, and I wish you a lot of success continued going forward. And I'll just keep buying your stuff as long as you keep making it.
Great. I like to hear that. Many thanks.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
Now at MajorSpoilers.com. That's it for this episode. Be back next week when I'll have another great interview with another wonderful comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.